and pulling out the ring while on the Jumbotron, only to have their would-be date or partner publicly reject them. It's not mythical to be that out of touch with your love interest.
Honestly, reflecting on the mythical lengths we went to in those days of young love reveals a deficit of mythicality that we've brought to our marriages as we've aged. Today, we direct a very large percentage of our creative energy toward our audience. Unfortunately, we think this has resulted in us neglecting to bring that same creativity to romancing our wives. Here's to you, wives, and a commitment to mythically romancing you in the years to come. Chapter 11.
Invent something ridiculous.
In fourth grade, we were given the opportunity to compete in the nationwide invention contest known as Invent America. It was our chance to show our school, and potentially the entire country, the extent of our creative genius. We both took the contest very seriously, carrying a secret hope that if we came up with the right idea, we could bypass school and become self-made child millionaires who lived in kid mansions, with entire rooms devoted to our favorite candies. Naturally, we would let the other guy, the one with the inferior invention idea, stay in the guest house, which would be a smaller version of the big house. It was all planned out.
I don't recall the exact name of my invention, but it was essentially a large U-shaped comb that you could run across your head in order to comb all your hair in one direction, forward, backward, or even sideways. We had been instructed to invent something that met a particular need or solved a problem. I guess I thought that some people might need to comb all their hair in the same direction in 2 seconds or less. While I'm sure this concept strikes you as revolutionary, my product was actually beset with challenges. Knowing that it was advisable to develop a model of my idea, or better yet, a fully functional prototype, I took 2 non-matching combs from my house, ran a lighter up and down the length of them to soften the plastic, and bent them into a curve shape. I then joined the 2 combs together with duct tape, which left a 2-inch wide section in the middle that was essentially combless. This comb-free zone was not ideal. Another issue with my U-comb was, well, trying to comb with it. If you kept it low enough to touch your head, it would rake right over your ears when you moved it forward or backward. If you were a fan of the sideways comb, it would inadvertently comb your eyebrows as it moved from side to side. Despite these inherent limitations, I figured the kinks would be worked out once it went into mass production. Unfortunately, the judges didn't see it that way. To my surprise and disappointment, I didn't win my class.
My invention tackled a much more practical issue than unidirectional hair combing: having to wear sunglasses while driving. I'm not entirely sure why I thought this was a huge problem. As an adult, I actually think it's pretty cool to wear sunglasses while driving. But as a child, I apparently thought it was such a huge inconvenience that it warranted the invention of a retractable sheet of tinting. When a button was pressed, it would slide out from within the roof of the car and cover the entire windshield, forever eliminating the need to take the extra 4 seconds to don a pair of shades before pulling away. I called my product the Sun Shield. I knew I wasn't capable of building a full-size prototype, so I created a 3D diorama that fit entirely inside of a shoebox. My car was made from red construction paper, and my sun shield was a piece of black construction paper that I would slide from the roof down to the windshield. Each time I slid the black paper in place, I thought of all the millions of pairs of sunglasses that would now have to be discarded because of my landmark invention. No doubt, I was destined to win the class. But I forgot to account for Matthew Enzor. You remember, that fast kid from Chapter 1. Like some sort of magician, Matthew Enzor showed up on the day of the reveal with a fully functioning apparatus that he called the Scissor Spoon. It was a spoon split in half that operated like a pair of scissors, and according to Matthew was, quote, "especially useful for the consumption of garden peas," end quote. I knew I was beat as soon as I saw him demonstrating it in class. He even brought in the freaking peas! He explained later that his dad, Benny, had made the prototype using some special tools at his job. I thought that was a little unfair, but I couldn't deny the genius of the idea. Matthew won the class contest, and my dreams of hearing the sounds of sun shields retracting into cars all across the nation were dashed.
While we never got to move into that childhood mansion, we're grateful that we ultimately stumbled into a career that allows us to conceptualize buttloads of weird inventions. Good Mythical Morning, in particular, has been the birthplace of a series of ridiculous ideas. You probably won't find any of our inventions on the shelves at Target next year. Maybe Big Lots if we're lucky. Fortunately, we don't have to make a living selling our stupid contraptions, but conceptualizing something ridiculous is a mythical thing to do. Mythical Mall, an assortment of good mythical inventions.
The Concho Poncert. It's been proven that there is a 74% chance that you will have a drink spilled on you if you attend a Kenny Chesney concert. With the Concho Poncert, this is no longer a problem, but rather something you can actually look forward to. Protect your clothes and use the special attached drinking tube to enjoy the spilled beverage yourself. $81.93.
Water tasting apparatus. Sharing a drink with your friend using two straws is so 1950s. And who wants to risk spreading a global pandemic by drinking after another person? Thankfully, there's the dual action water tasting apparatus, not to be confused with the dual action juice tasting apparatus. $19.99.
The Smell-O-Vator. Smelling one thing while eating another can be a delightful or horrifying experience, and the only way to do it reliably is with the Smell-O-Vator. It may look like an upside-down visor with a hole cut out for the mouth, but it's so much more. $21.99.
The Blow Cooker. Microwaves are expensive and scary. Hair dryers are safe and familiar. With the Blow Cooker, a four-part system consisting of a hula hoop, multiple hair dryers, soda bottles, and a Lazy Susan, you can cook a chicken with hot, steady air. Spinning required. Warning, the Blow Cooker has never even gotten close to cooking a chicken to a temperature recommended by the USDA. $34.99.
Pool Pants. The best way to stay cool is to stay in the pool. Actual pools are expensive and full of strangers' urine. Stay out of the public pool and in your own private pool pants. $122.21.
The Spurt. Shopping for clothes that fit perfectly can be a time-consuming process. Those days are over thanks to The Spurt, a spray-on shirt made entirely from silly string. Extremely breathable, lightweight, and multicolored. A buddy is required if you want to have back coverage. $3.95.
Often, inventing doesn't even require making anything. Just imagining. During many of our Will It Food episodes on GMM, we've come up with restaurant ideas that should never actually welcome any actual patrons. Like the mall food court dumpling eatery that offers a free extra dumpling with every order. Take a dumpling on us. Of course, if you're a restaurant investor listening to this and you want to take a chance on Take a Dumpling on Us, let's talk.
While playing the classic board game Operation on the show, we discussed a potential version of the game called Operation with Stakes, where instead of pulling strange plastic items out of the man's body, players would pull out actual pieces of steak. It's a meal and a game. Although we discussed this idea publicly on the internet, no Hasbro representatives have contacted us. Why? Because it was a horrible idea, but it led to a mythical conversation.
Although we've never had one of our stupid ideas become a well-known and useful product for the public at large, there is a precedent for dumb ideas taking the world by storm. Think about the Snuggie. Neither of us have ever actually seen a person wearing one unironically. But, as evidenced by the hundreds of millions of dollars in sales it has generated, lots of people have decided to spend their hard-earned money on that ludicrous blanket costume that seems like something we would have joked about on GMM.
The Flobee is no different. It's a vacuum cleaner hooked up to hair clippers, the kind of thing that a demented but resourceful parent would create to punish their children. That didn't stop more than 2 million people from buying one during the 90s, because apparently sucking your hair up into a tube and chopping it off at a specified length is a pretty awesome way to cut hair.
Who knows? Maybe someday one of our misguided brain children will blossom into a successful business of its own. Our greatest hope at the moment is our grandiose idea of creating a barbecue sauce that doubles as cologne. There have been barbecue-scented colognes and possibly cologne-scented barbecue sauces, but no one has pulled off the delicate balance of taste and smell in a non-staining, sprayable liquid that won't poison the user. Until that day, we're going to have to place our trust in you. We're hoping that some mythical beast out there will be inspired by this chapter to formulate their own preposterous ideas.
But I'm not creative, you might say. We're not buying it. The ability to invent isn't something you either have or don't. There may be some people who are more prolific at generating ideas, but creativity is a process that comes naturally to every person. Inventing something is less about forcing out an idea and more about simply letting your brain work the way it naturally does. If you let your thoughts form without second-guessing yourself, you'll find that you've got your own set of bizarre inventions waiting to emerge. And, if we're any indication, the bar is pretty low. Look at us wearing the Smell-O-Vator one more time, and remember that we are proud of that.
Go forth and invent. Just promise us that you'll invite us over to your massive house to see the candy-filled rooms when your invention becomes the next scissor spoon. Best Worst Inventions.
In 2010, Time published a list entitled The 50 Worst Inventions. We took issue with this list for several reasons, starting with the unspeakable inclusion of some amazingly weird and creative inventions, like Huniger, which was a mixture of honey and apple cider vinegar and developed by a man with one of the greatest inventor names of all time, Dr. DeForest C. Jarvis. Then there was also the issue of some pop culture cheap shots, like the criticism levied against the Segway.
We get it. The Segway didn't revolutionize personal transportation, but one of the 50 worst inventions of all time? Come on. Have you tried the beef bacon ranch quesadilla at Chili's? Anyhow, our biggest gripe with the time list is the fact that it exists at all, because we believe strongly that there is no such thing as a bad invention. To prove it, we've provided cross-examinations for 5 of the entries.
1. Fake ponytails. This is one of the most underappreciated fashion accessories of the last century. When paired with a single dangly earring and a business suit, a fake ponytail is guaranteed to grant you access to virtually any event, even if you didn't RSVP. You don't even need to feather your bangs, but it doesn't hurt.
2. Smell-O-Vision. Time describes Smell-O-Vision as a failed gimmick. The idea was to outfit theaters with special vents, which would allow filmmakers to incorporate distinct smells into their storytelling. Only one Smell-O-Vision movie was ever made, The Scent of Mystery. That's a shame. To understand the potential for Smell-O-Vision, simply bake a dish of ratatouille and then watch Ratatouille, making sure to hold the ratatouille up to your nose each time it appears on screen. It'll blow your mind.
3. Pontiac Aztec. The Aztec is often decried as one of the ugliest cars ever made, but we believe that the design was simply way ahead of its time. Sure, the intergalactically angular design might have looked out of place when compared to the Dodge Neons of its day, but the Aztec exterior has aged a lot better than, say, the Geo Metro. Bonus fun fact, the Aztec was part of the prize package for Richard Hatch, the winner of the first season of Survivor. Good enough for the Hatch, good enough for us.
4. The Comfort Wipe. The Comfort Wipe looks eerily similar to the slightly flexible plastic stick that non-athletic people use to throw tennis balls to their dogs. But this is an extended butt wiper. Any product that allows you to maintain at least 12 inches of hand-to-butt clearance while wiping should be celebrated.
5. The Baby Cage. Gotta be honest, this one is tough to defend. In the early 20th century, big city nannies found a solution for taking care of babies in cramped apartments: hanging a wire cage outside their windows and putting the baby in there. It sounds horrible and abusive, and might have the worst branding of any product ever. However, when compared with the option of leaving a baby to fend for itself in an apartment where every surface was covered in asbestos and lead paint, a fresh air escape pod, better branding, seemed like a lifesaver.
Bonus section. An ode to the best/worst invention on the road, the Spider, a.k.a. the reverse trike motorbike. You've seen it on the road, and there's no doubt that it's raised some questions. Is that a motorcycle? Are ATVs allowed on the highway? Why does that thing look like a Kawasaki Ninja mated with a golf cart? Over the last 10 years, there has not been a single invention more deserving of the title best/worst invention. There's one way to take each and every ounce of badassery out of riding a motorcycle. Put 2 training wheels on the front.
But we must admit that every person we ever saw riding one looked incredibly happy. Ridiculous, but happy. And if we're being honest, we'd gladly accept an offer to ride a pair of them around town while running errands for our wives. Of course, we would wear blacked-out face-covering helmets, both for protection and anonymity. Chapter 12.
Give Throwback Thanks.
As we explained earlier, Miss Locklear played a huge role in kickstarting our friendship when she punished us for defacing our desks. Plus, she was instrumental in establishing this whole mythical theme, seeing as how she made us color those mythical beasts. But Miss Lockler isn't just mythical because she was present for the beginning of our friendship. She's mythical because she cared about her students and sparked our curiosity and creativity, even as first graders. Oh, and it didn't hurt that she was hot. We had as big a crush on her as was possible for prepubescent boys. While the rest of the world had Heather Locklear to drool over, we had Lenora Locklear. Also, it's worth noting that Van Halen's Hot for Teacher came out the same year we met Miss Locklear. Coincidence? We think not.
We lost touch with Miss Locklear after elementary school, but she was never far from our hearts. So, in 2006, we decided it would be cool to find her and tell her how much she meant to us 23 years later. We could have just looked her up online and called her, but what's the fun in that? Instead, we chose to use only word of mouth, and we made a feature-length documentary about the process, appropriately titled Looking for Miss Locklear. It's available online, and you should watch it if for no other reason than to see Rhett with a chin strap and me without glasses. Spoiler alert, we found her. Obviously. Who wants to watch a movie called Looking for Miss Locklear that doesn't include finding Miss Locklear?
After talking to dozens of people over a period of weeks, riding around in the bed of a pickup truck selling puppies door to door, playing music at a Native American cultural festival, and attending a congressional hearing, we finally found ourselves face to face with then Principal Locklear. She emerged from her office as a silhouette, backlit by the sun. It makes a great scene. And remembered us as soon as she saw our faces. We had the chance to sit down with Miss Locklear and tell her how significant she was to us. There was laughter. There were tears. It was mythical.
And Miss Locklear thought it was pretty cool, too.
I was the first grade teacher at Boyce Creek Elementary for 10 years, so there were many children whom I had taught. Years later, when two men walked into my office at school, I immediately knew who they were, Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal. It had been more than 20 years. What a wonderful feeling to reunite with these once first-grade students of mine who were now grown men. They shared their timeline of school, college, family, and friendship since my first grade class. Their journey to find me and their thanking me in person was a beautiful reminder that I had influenced the lives of not only Rhett and Link, but many students during my 35 years in education.
Recently, while reflecting on our afternoon with Miss Locklear in 2006, we thought, that was amazing. We need to do that again. Not go looking for Miss Locklear again, which would be a little weird, but rather recreate the experience of thanking people from our past without warning. We want that elixir of surprise, nostalgia, and gratitude to be something that happens more than just once a decade, and also something that doesn't necessarily require us to make a documentary.
But thanking people can be difficult. There are some times when it comes more easily than others, like when someone holds a door open for you or lets you cut in front of them at the TSA line when you're late for a flight, or sacrifices themselves by pushing you out of the way and taking a dollop of pigeon crap right on the head. This may seem unlikely, but you can't prove it's never happened. In these moments, it would almost be unnatural not to say thank you.
However, when someone does more than just a solitary act of kindness, such as pigeon defecation interception, PDI, and invest time and effort into helping you through a difficult circumstance or teaching you something invaluable, it can be difficult to find the right time to express your gratitude. And the longer you wait, the tougher it gets. Thanking someone from your past requires taking the risk of being vulnerable, but it makes a real difference in the life of whomever you choose to thank. This risk-reward is exactly why it's a mythical thing to do.
Of course, it's best to thank someone in person. If they're the person who pointed out the horrible halitosis that had been plaguing each of your relationships for years, you can lean in very close to them and use a very breathy voice to show them that your stank breath is really gone. If you're thanking a New Orleans voodoo psychic for reading your palms and then convincing you to break up with your loser boyfriend, you can burn a picture of your ex right in front of the priestess and then give her a chicken foot necklace. They are widely available online at very reasonable prices.
Unfortunately, arranging these types of meetings can be impractical. And so, in an effort to bring more gratitude into the world, we humbly propose a simple concept that allows you to show gratitude with a tool you use every day. Throwback thanks. Hashtag TBT.
We know what you're thinking. Hashtag TBT already exists. It stands for Throwback Thursday. a day when we carefully curate snapshots from the past to remind our online friends how cute we used to be. A select brave few of us occasionally share an embarrassing picture or two from our more socially awkward days, but really that's just undercover narcissism, as we are hoping that someone out there will find us more endearing because of our willingness to release a picture with our best friend in which we wear matching purple shirts with gorillas on them at the North Carolina Zoo. And you can seem even more endearing when you recreate said picture as adults.
You're right. Hashtag TBT is taken. And seeing as how we once fought an online war with two different morning TV news shows, Good Morning Memphis and Good Morning Maryland, for the sole use of hashtag GMM, we won, we can respect that a hashtag's meaning is somewhat sacred. So, instead of trying to change the definition of hashtag TBT, why don't we just expand it?
Let's make hashtag TBT mean more than us just showcasing ourselves to the world. Start seeing Thursdays as an opportunity to throw some thanks to someone who deserves it. If you'd like to stick with the traditionally visually driven nature of hashtag TBT, include a picture.
Once you get going, it's pretty easy to jog your memory and generate a list of people who deserve some throwback thanks. We've written some thank you notes of our own that might help to get you started. You may not have had experiences as strange as ours, but there's no doubt you've got more than a handful of people who have helped you in some way that deserves a shout out. Make their day mythical by putting yourself out there and saying thank you. Our throwback thank yous.
Benny Enzor, thank you for not being self-conscious about being in a band with a bunch of teenagers when you were in your 40s, and thanks for letting us play all those weird songs that you wrote in the 70s that sounded like Eagles B-sides.
Trent Hamilton, thanks for agreeing to be our first drummer even though A, you didn't yet own a drum kit, or B, know how to play drums.
Dick Bowser, thank you for nearly choking on a piece of meat at a Myrtle Beach steakhouse. We literally think about you every time we eat meat and throw in a few extra chews for you.
Mrs. Ennis, thank you for not realizing that the guy on the tape that Rhett brought into your U.S. history class to play for extra credit was actually just Rhett doing a terrible British accent.
Old man with a shotgun at pig farm, thank you for not shooting directly at us, but just over our heads, when you were chasing us off of your farm after we got the idea to leave the high school football game one Friday night and attempt to ride pigs with Michael Juby.
Michael Juby, thank you for being willing to leave the football game to attempt to ride pigs with us.
Heather Wilson, thank you for grabbing Link's hair in one hand and slapping him with the other in eighth grade. He can't remember what he said, but he's been trying not to say anything stupid since then, to varying degrees of success.
Bleachers next to the Harnett Central basketball bench, thank you for breaking Rhett's big toe when he threw a tantrum and kicked you after missing a flurry of three-pointers against Western Harnett.
Garfield-shaped phone, thank you for being the conduit for those couple of extremely awkward conversations Link had with Leslie before she decided to dump him for Tyler Hamilton.
Big Bird, thank you for allowing Rhett to dress as you for Halloween as a preschooler. You helped him believe that being freakishly tall doesn't necessarily make you a freak.
Hurricane Fran, thank you for not throwing a tree on us our freshman year when we cluelessly rode our bikes around NC State's campus saying, man, it sure is windy out here tonight.
Todd Smith and Mark Valentine, thank you for challenging us to watch all 384 minutes of Lonesome Dove in one sitting. Our urologists have traced our current conditions back to this and would like to speak with you.
North Carolina Highway Patrolman, thank you for helping us clear the debris from the interstate that flew out of the back of Link's truck. And thank you for the added touch of issuing a citation that literally said, failure to secure load on it.
Chewing tobacco, thank you for having a sobering warning printed on your packaging as well as for tasting absolutely awful. You made us vomit as 16-year-olds and then vow to never try you again.
Our friend Jared, who worked at Baskin-Robbins, thanks for all those free samples that were the size of normal ice cream cones, man. You really put your job at risk for us.
Brian Ratledge, thank you for telling us about fiber supplements. We're like clockwork now.
College roommate Greg, thanks for refusing to ever wear a belt. That night you ran out of our dorm and didn't stop until your pants fell all the way down and made you fall on your face was priceless.
College roommate Tim, thanks for finally cleaning up all your Halloween candy. Oh, wait. That wasn't you. That was the giant rat who stuffed it all inside our couch where he had made a nest for himself.
Shirtless college professor, Thanks for not acknowledging Link when he bent over in the locker room and accidentally pressed his bare butt cheeks against your back.
Pharmacist at Elliot's in downtown Fuquay. Thanks for taking a break filling prescriptions to hold the mic for our epic rap battle video behind your store.
The Dunn Daily Record. Thank you for featuring us on your June 26, 2009 cover, alongside Irwin Woman Murdered, Teen Charged, and Sampson Horse Farm in Trouble Again.
Chapter 13.
Visit the Future.
In Chapter 2, Get Lost, we suggested that a mythical approach to life is to simply pick a direction and go, instead of getting overly bogged down and attempting to plan every detail of your future. That sense of adventure and risk-taking is at the heart of mythicality. However, there are times when knowing something about the future can help you take better informed risks. If your cousin builds a Ferris wheel in his backyard, there is a reasonable expectation that someone will die on it. Turning down his repeated offers to take a ride doesn't mean you're not mythical. It means you're smart.
Most of the time, we can only make educated guesses about the future. But there are some instances in which we can know the future definitively. This chapter is one of those times. You're going to have a difficult time believing us, but this chapter was, or will be, written in the year 2075. We are not at liberty to explain the particulars of how we accomplished this, and we would risk irrevocably altering your time stream if we were to introduce time travel technology in this book. All we can tell you is that time travel involves getting inside what looks like a Pontiac Aztec. So, if you're currently driving one, hold on to it. Its value will increase dramatically in the future.
Hello from 2075. We hope we can be of help to you, dear mythical beast from the past. We would love to take the time to outline your future in great detail, but that would be a direct violation of the Universal Time Travel Act of 2064. So instead, we will be focusing on telling you what our lives have been like over the years. If you were to read the physical version of this book, you would notice that this chapter is employing a different font. That font is Futura. Not because we think that's funny, but because coincidentally, Futura actually became the font of the future.
In the year 2075, we are both 97 years old. Before you begin to picture two frail, elderly men, you must know that 97 is no longer considered old. Thanks to exponential advancements in human longevity, we are basically middle-aged. Nobody knows for sure, but we won't be surprised to make it to 200. We look remarkably similar to how we looked when we wrote the rest of this book, thanks to a number of extremely effective skin regeneration treatments. Sadly, the one thing that has not yet been discovered is a solution to male pattern baldness.
Over the past decades, we have stopped and restarted Good Mythical Morning a number of times. Every 10 years or so, we get burned out, and then, when a new technology comes along, we start it back up. Our current version of the show is something you would barely recognize. You see, in the future, about 70% of the world's population is permanently connected to what you might call the Internet. This is done using a subdermal wireless system installed at birth. Some parents refuse the implant, leaving these children to later wear something that looks strikingly similar to a Bluetooth earpiece. It is still not cool.
While you would guess that this network has a catchy name like The Hive, it's just called the Interwebs. Yes, with a Z. The Z is a thing again. Everyone on the Interwebs is constantly giving and taking information from it, and we can no longer distinguish it from our own original thoughts and memories. It sounds scary, but trust us, you will think it's awesome when you can instantly access not just the recipe for gluten-free lab-grown beef stroganoff, but, better yet, the sense of memory of what it is like to have just eaten gluten-free lab-grown beef stroganoff without actually having to eat it.
GMM consists of a 15-minute period every weekday where subscribers simply tune in to our minds. Around the year 2060 or so, after years of being accused of it by commenters, we actually ran out of stuff to do on the show. So, we don't do anything, and no one watches. People find it much more entertaining to experience us thinking about things that are physically impossible. And we probably shouldn't admit this, but 2 years ago, we purchased a creativity bot named LL Coolbot that generates the thoughts for us.
Today's episode is about the two of us stretching ourselves into infinitely small strings across the entire universe, and then winding ourselves around a vintage fishing rod and reel from your time and being used as fishing line. We are then taken on a deep-sea fishing trip where no one catches anything. This may sound strange to you now, but this is absolutely hilarious in the year 2075. It was the bot's idea. LL was worth the money.
Even with our trusty creativity bot, it's hard to keep up with competition in the future. There are an overwhelming number of entertainment options, and people can create nearly any experience using simulation software that is indistinguishable from reality. All it takes is a little well-written code for people to enjoy a version of GMM with two links, or two RETs, or an actual RET-Link Fusion, RINK. These knockoff versions of the show tend to be even more popular than ours. We are personally fond of Bad Mythical Morning, a gory version of GMM, and it's impossible to stop their proliferation.
The 2050s were a golden age for GMM, thanks in large part to developments in protein-arranging nanotech that allowed every food imaginable to be created. We were able to push our Will It episodes further than we ever imagined. Our most viewed episode is from 2054, in which we asked, "Will it still taste good if it drives into my mouth?" We arranged various foods into small remote-controlled vessels and had them directed into our mouths. Link had to be airlifted to the ER when the macaroni and golf cart was lodged in his throat and could not back out because we forgot to enable reverse.
We're still best friends, although there was a rough patch. In 2045, the government finally figured out how to accurately digitize thoughts. Shortly after that, a law was passed that allowed intelligence agencies to monitor and record thoughts for the greater good. Don't worry, 20 years later, this finally backfired and thought monitoring is now illegal. But there was one interesting byproduct of these mental databases. Services that could evaluate your mind and then perfectly match you with the most compatible mate, best friend, business partner, or whatever you were seeking. Because all the mythical beasts insisted, we put our names in the mix to see who our ideal best friends would be. They were hoping against hope that, out of the 10 billion people in the world, we'd be a perfect best friend match for each other. We weren't.
Link matched up with a guy named Alejandro from Guadalajara, and I matched up with Siphon, a horse implanted with a human consciousness. We agreed to meet Alejandro and Siphon for the fun of it, thinking it would be a good idea for a GMM episode, but we underestimated the impact of being face-to-face with the person, or manimal, you are most compatible with in the entire world. When Link met Alejandro, there was an instant connection. Without planning it, they had each brought the other a cereal variety pack as a gift. After a long embrace, they sat down and worked their way through the cereals, smiling and laughing like old friends.
When Rhett met Siphon, the horse lowered himself onto one knee, inviting Rhett to mount him. Even though he had very little experience with horses, Rhett hopped right up on Siphon's back, without a saddle, and they began to ride. That first day, they lost track of time and rode all the way through the night and ended up in Vegas, where they enjoyed the Tournament of Kings horseback show, Siphon's favorite, at the Excalibur Casino.
These connections with Alejandro and Siphon were so overwhelmingly strong that we collectively decided to do what we never thought we would. We took a break from being best friends. The great best friend break lasted 3 years, from 2048 to 2050. During that time, Link and Alejandro began their own internet show called Linkahandro. The show was a huge hit, mostly due to a very catchy theme song in which Linkahandro was sung to the tune of Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way.
Meanwhile, Rhett decided to leave entertainment behind, and he and Siphon began to trot across the earth. Rhett quit grooming himself, and his hair and beard grew until they eventually formed a large single dreadlock that dragged the ground and attracted flies. There was a critically acclaimed documentary made about them entitled Man and Man Horse.
In late 2050, as fate would have it, both Siphon and I and Link and Alejandro traveled to an active volcano in Indonesia. Link barely recognized his old best friend, but once we began talking, the memories came flooding back. We decided right then and there to form a super best friend group of the four of us. Link suggested that Alejandro take a ride on Siphon. Siphon reluctantly agreed. As soon as Alejandro was on Siphon's back, you could almost taste the incompatibility. Siphon became instantly enraged, bucking and twisting, trying to eject Alejandro from his back. In his fury, he didn't realize he was approaching the rim of the volcano, and before we had a chance to stop them, Siphon and Alejandro fell over the edge and into the molten rock, bursting into flames. It was very sad, but it looked awesome.
After that, we traveled back to Los Angeles, We were best friends again, and we rarely speak about Alejandro or Siphon. There's so much more we could tell you, but the Aztec is running out of gas, and we've got to return to our time. We probably shouldn't do this, but because we care about you so much, we're willing to violate the UTTA of 2064. These are the most important things we can tell you about the future.
Number one, in 2024, McDonald's finally and officially phased out the McRib. It was literally available at zero locations. They threatened it many times, but 2024 is the year that it became officially official. Get it while it's hot.
Number two, in 2036, an asteroid was heading directly toward Earth, and scientists determined that the impact would be catastrophic. All the governments of the world collaborated in order to get every human on the planet to face the same direction and simultaneously sneeze in order to move the planet out of the way. Just as everyone was about to sneeze, Bruce Willis came out of retirement, took a private shuttle to the asteroid, and blew it up, sacrificing himself and saving the world.
Number three. In 2043, a massive flu pandemic took the world by storm. Millions and millions of healthy people fell victim to the disease. It turns out that the key to survival was deceptively simple. All you had to do to fight off the virus was...
Huh. I guess we got cut off. Probably wasn't that important. Anyhow, we trust you gained some clarity about your own future based on ours. We sincerely hope that we have not ruined your present by making you long for the day when you can have food driven into your mouth. If you feel like the details of our future conquest weren't helpful to you personally, we can at least offer you some encouragement that learning to anticipate your own future can be a great way to accomplish it.
If you want to land a mythical job one day, say, for example, be a software developer responsible for the massively popular immersive experience known as Bad Mythical Morning, it would be helpful to think about what things would have to be true about you in the future if this were to be the case. First of all, you'd be someone who understood how to write code, which means that sometime between now and then, you've got to learn code. That may sound overly simplistic, but it's actually a remarkably powerful way to begin working toward a goal. When you finally develop BMM, just know that we will expect royalties. The time we showed Matt Damon the future.
Back to the Future 2 was a huge movie for our generation. And when October 21st, 2015, the day that Marty McFly traveled to in the movie to save his future family, rolled around, the internet exploded with lists fact-checking what the movie predicted right and wrong about the future. For example,
what they got right: hands-free video games, wireless payments, fingerprint recognition software, and video glasses.
What they got wrong: flying cars, dog-walking robots, hoverboards, real ones, not the lame ones with the wheels, and size-adjusting and auto-drying clothes.
People love movies that predict the future, and you may have noticed that Matt Damon went on a future films bender in the mid-2010s. This was no accident. In fact, it was our fault. More specifically, our future selves' fault.
In the year 2062, we made a mistake. On the 50th anniversary of the beginning of GMM, we decided to go back in time to the beginning of 2012 and fix a few things from season one that have always bugged us. Our set, a few jokes here and there, Rhett's whole look. But we incorrectly set the coordinates on our time machine and crash-landed in Matt Damon's backyard.
Matt instantly recognized our time machine for what it was, and being the curious man that he is and was, he had lots of questions. Long story short, we agreed to tell him about the future as long as he promised not to tell anyone, and therefore alter the future for everyone else. Matt agreed, but after hearing about the future, he was so excited about the future of space travel that he wanted to share some teasers with his fans.
As guys who by 2062 had spent half a century sharing nearly everything with their fans, we understood Matt's need and cut him a deal. He could share everything he had learned about space travel as long as he presented the accurate version of the future in a fictional movie. Furthermore, he also had to make two movies with false depictions of future space travel so that the public didn't get too close to the truth.
Being the reasonable man that he is, Matt agreed. And every year for the next 3 years, he starred in a film about space travel. Two of them are fictional, and one of them will prove to be totally accurate.
Elysium, 2013. Earth devolves into chaos, and all the rich people move to an idyllic space station.
Interstellar, 2014. Humanity is being destroyed by blight, and space travelers must head back through a black hole to find a habitable planet in order to save the human race.
The Martian, 2015. Obviously, this film is the one that's true. In fact, Matt Damon is actually on his way to Mars right now as you read this. The Matt Damon people see in movies and in Hollywood is actually a high-res hologram, the likes of which only the CIA had access to in 2017. Selfies in 100,000 years.
In 2013, artist and researcher Nikolai Lam and computational genomics whiz Dr. Alan Kwan offered up their predictions for what humans might look like in 100,000 years. Their models predicted a number of interesting features, including big foreheads to accommodate larger brains, big eyes that are able to see in the dark, imperceptible sensory enhancement implants, and larger nostrils for off-planet breathing.
While we have to applaud the efforts of these men of science, we are naturally obligated to pop their fantasy bubble with a needle of reality. To be clear, we are not claiming that our time machine has ventured 100,000 years into the future, but we're also not claiming it hasn't. If we had traveled that far into the future, we might have been able to produce the following photographs of our immortal future selves with explanations of each feature.
Hair crops. Our heads are farms that grow crops. And our hair can be planted as we see fit. We are self-sustaining. I grow beans, Link grows cereal.
Smart nostrils. Currently, it's necessary to smell a particularly nostalgic smell to trigger a memory. Smart nostrils eliminate this need using a microcomputer that fools your nasal passages into thinking you're smelling whichever smell you choose from your past. The only downside is that nose size is increased by 40%.
Standardized ears. Everybody has the same ears because they are the perfect size and shape to balance utility and attractiveness.
Bionic eyes. Companies are already developing bionic eyes that combine retinal implants with external eyeglass-mounted cameras. Can you imagine 100,000 years from now?
Motorized jaws. Mouths of the future feature strong robotic jaws and teeth, allowing for incredible chewing and talking speeds. Talking with your mouth full is not recommended, though. At these extreme speeds, food particles can be projected great distances during intense conversation.
Google Goozle. For too long, Adam's apples have served little purpose beyond a perceived indication of masculinity. In the future, Google sees this as a business opportunity and creates a biomechanical wonder, the Google Goozle, which allows users to Google something by pressing their Goozle.
Detachable heads. Our heads are all free-floating because the experiences we have in our subconscious are so much more vibrant than what we do on Earth. Also, we have the ability to place our heads on a variety of bodies depending on whether we want to fly, dive, disappear, and so on.
Chapter 14.
Become a Superfan.
Anyone who watches more than a handful of our videos learns pretty quickly the two of us are different. Our dissimilarities run deeper than one of us being freakishly tall and the other wearing glasses, or one of us preferring collared shirts with questionable color combinations and the other having a penchant for tight graphic tees. We tend to approach problems in distinct ways, and we often have different perspectives on a given topic. For example, we are on opposite sides of the long-standing cake versus pie debate. Despite our personality differences, we've found that we tend to be entertained by the same things. If one of us likes a movie, TV show, or band, chances are the other one will as well. This shared appreciation for entertainment reaches a pinnacle when it comes to one artist in particular.
In middle school, I was digging through some old cassette tapes of my dad's and stumbled upon a gem entitled Marlboro Country Music. It was exactly what it sounds like, a collection of country music hits compiled and sponsored by the good people at Marlboro Cigarettes. Seeing as the tape was released in 1986 and we were in North Carolina, the fact that a cigarette company would sponsor a country music album didn't seem odd to us at all. In retrospect, it's surprising that this wasn't done more often. Thankfully, the album didn't have Marlboro's intended effect of getting us to start smoking, but it did introduce an equally powerful addiction. One track was entitled Okie from Muskogee by a man named Merle Haggard. It was enthralling. The music was unlike any country music I'd ever heard. And the lyrics were golden, featuring pontifications such as, "We don't let our hair grow long and shaggy," and "Leather boots are still in style for manly footwear." This was the work of a genius, and seeing as how I was currently sporting the Rudolph, I agreed with his sentiments about hairstyles for men. I was hooked. I immediately called Link and told him I had discovered something special. When he arrived, I queued up the song and pressed play. We sat there in silence and listened to the entire song. When it was over, Link said, "Play it again."
I remember feeling like I had discovered a portal to another world. After hearing that one song, we committed to spending what little allowance we had on Merle's music. I asked my mom to take us to the Sam Goody music store at the mall, where we pillaged the Merle Haggard section, filling our arms with bunches of cassette tapes in those massive plastic cases designed to prevent shoplifting. Once we arrived home, we put tape after tape into my stereo and listened to songs about doing prison time in San Quentin, living as a hobo on a train, working overtime to be able to buy Christmas presents for the children, and drowning the memory of a woman in 190-proof whiskey. Of course, we couldn't actually relate to any of what Merle was singing about, but we desperately wanted to. Eventually, we became intimately familiar with the majority of Merle's songs. He released about 600 of them during his career. We would sit together in one of our rooms and just sing along, doing our best to capture Merle's iconic twang, hitting every gravelly dip and yodeling falsetto of his voice. And although the image of two teenage boys sitting in a room next to a stereo, singing old country songs with lyrics like, "There they say he met up with some women dressed in yellow and scarlet. Their warm lips like a honeycomb, dripped with honey," might seem awkward to you, we never thought about that. We were lost in the Merle zone. In large part, our ability to harmonize with each other came from those Merle sessions, when I began to try to mimic the notes of his background singers. In high school, Rhett started to compile mixtapes by packing as much Merle onto a single long play cassette as he could. He would carefully craft these tapes, giving them names like Merle, Wall to Wall, and writing an iconic introduction on the lined cover. Rhett would offer these mixtapes to me as tokens of our shared love of Merle. One of his mixtapes was called Merle 45 Minutes of Pleasure. While that was definitely a questionable title, I didn't question it at the time because he was right. Listening to Merle for 45 minutes was one of the most pleasurable things I could think of.
Merle, 45 Minutes of Pleasure. Warning. This tape contains the legal limit of Merle Haggard songs. Overexposure to Merle could lead to extremely good times. Merle Wall to Wall set records with its massive amount of Merle, but Merle Wall to Wall 2 has set new and better standards. No tape has ever been equipped with this much Merle. You are now a proud and dignified owner of the best tape ever assembled. Merle, live on, buddy. Having so thoroughly immersed ourselves in Merle's music, we jumped at the chance to see him perform live in the fall of 1994 in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Instead of inviting anyone along with us, we knew that this first real-life Merle experience should be reserved just for the two of us. When we entered the venue, we immediately noticed that we seemed to be the only 16-year-old boys who had come to see him, apart from a few teenagers who had been dragged out by their parents. We sat down and waited for him to emerge. When Merle moseyed out on stage in a black suit and his signature short brim hat, my eyes swelled up with tears. I looked over at Link, and his eyes were also wet. This was the man whose voice had filled our ears countless times, his music serving as a glue that bonded us together as friends, and we were seeing him in the flesh. As he worked his way through his massive arsenal of hits, we found ourselves unable to sing along. There was something too sacred about hearing him in person. And even though his voice didn't have quite the same powerful tone as it did on the tapes we'd memorized, it was a magical night. When the concert was over, we didn't want it to end. So instead of driving home, we walked around to the back of the building and found Merle's tour bus. We took turns posing in front of it as if it were the Eiffel Tower. Then, like a couple of stalkers, we stood taking pictures of Merle's family through the windows. I don't know what we were expecting. Maybe we secretly hoped that Merle would stop on his way to the bus, see us, and say, "Hey, boys, I can tell y'all are my biggest fans. Want to come see the inside of my bus and meet my family?" Merle eventually exited the building and walked the short distance to the bus, stopping quickly to acknowledge the fans who had gathered, which, besides us, consisted exclusively of people over 40. He didn't single us out or even make eye contact, but we were determined. The bus pulled out, and without thinking, we hopped in Link's Nissan pickup and began following it. We figured that the bus might stop in town at a hotel, at which point we'd get our chance to commune with Merle. But after navigating through town, the bus got on the highway. Helpless, we continued to trail it. Link said, "Well, somebody on that bus has to stop and use the bathroom sooner or later." So we kept on, not pausing to consider that tour buses had bathrooms. After following Merle for over an hour, we started to get scared. We were North Carolina boys, frightened by the possibility of running out of gas somewhere in the middle of South Carolina, where we'd be captured by locals and forced to denounce our state and swear allegiance to their flag. Reluctantly, we turned back.
We may have missed our opportunity to meet Merle, but our obsession with him continued to grow. During our junior year in Mrs. Royal's English class, we were tasked with writing senior term papers, which would contribute substantially to our final grade. Mrs. Royal informed us that our papers could be about anything we desired, as long as it was a genuine topic of interest and something we could write about compellingly. Of course, we both chose Merle Haggard as our subject. When Mrs. Royal explained that no two students could have the same topic, we selected two different aspects of Merle Haggard and pleaded with her to let us proceed. She relented. My paper was entitled Merle Haggard's Depiction of the Western Culture in the Late 60s, and Rhett's was Merle Haggard's Musical Commentary on the Prisoner Experience in Correctional Facilities. While other students saw their term papers as obligatory school assignments, we relished the opportunity to research and report on the man who had changed our lives. We both got A's.
That same year, I was taking an advanced math class that required a graphing calculator, specifically the TI-82. While I could have been learning to better prepare myself for the 4 years of calculus to follow in engineering school, I instead spent 90% of the time in my advanced math class writing a Merle-themed choose-your-own-adventure game in the calculator's basic program editor. The goal of the game was to bust Merle out of San Quentin, the prison he actually did time in. After navigating through a series of pitfalls to reach the prison, you had to incapacitate his large and intimidating cellmate before rescuing Merle. If you succeeded, you were rewarded by being able to travel with Merle to his home on Lake Shasta, where you could fish with him forever. I've since lost that calculator, which contained the only version of the game that existed. I consider it one of my finest creative accomplishments.
Our admiration for Merle and his music carried over into adulthood. Over the years, I've been collecting all of Merle's original vinyl records to fill our Merle wall, which we've had in every office we've ever occupied together. That's no easy task, since Merle released 49 country albums during his career, and that number goes over 100 if you include gospel, Christmas, live, collaboration, and compilation albums. Whenever we've moved into a new space, five total since 2007, the first and most important question is, which wall will be the Merle wall? Once that is established, we move on to other less important issues like, how do we get the electricity turned on?
We had always dreamed of meeting Merle in person, but we had never really taken any steps to make it happen, beyond chasing his bus into South Carolina. But thanks to our thoughtful wives, everything changed in 2013. One evening, they surprised us with tickets to a Merle concert in Beverly Hills at the Sabin Theater the very next night. Then they informed us that they had pulled some strings and arranged a backstage meeting with Merle. Our hearts began to race. Before I knew it, I was tearing up. We were not emotionally prepared to meet our hero, and it was happening in less than 24 hours. The next day, we couldn't focus on anything else. We stressed out about what we should wear. Would Merle judge us because our jeans were so tight? Should we dress like two up-and-coming country singers? We wanted to impress him. My stomach was churning all day, and I visited the restroom no fewer than 4 times. My body was evacuating everything, making sure I was totally cleansed in preparation for our rendezvous with Merle. We decided to be ourselves, trusting that Merle would respect that. We were given instructions from Merle's booking agent, Lance, to wait next to the backstage doors outside the theater so Merle could stop and meet us on his way to the stage. We got there much earlier than was necessary and took our post outside the doors, anxious to not say or do anything stupid when we saw him. Standing there for close to an hour, we had figured out just the right angle for a picture with him, making sure the lighting would be perfect for this mythical moment we had anticipated our entire lives.
Eventually, the door of the bus opened, and out came our hero, dressed head to toe in black. He slowly walked toward us. My palms were pouring sweat. I braced myself for eye contact with him. Then, with his head down, he walked right past the door and right past us. There was another door. We were standing next to the wrong door. We panicked. Thankfully, Lance saw all this go down and chased in after Merle. We followed him. He said, "Merle, hold on. I got some boys I want you to meet." When we entered the theater, it was pitch black, the only light coming from a crack in the curtain leading to the stage. Merle's band was already playing the intro to the first song, waiting for him to join them on stage. As our eyes adjusted, we realized that Merle was standing right next to us. I could smell him. I can't describe the smell, but it was good. I froze. To his credit, Lance was on top of things. "Let's get a picture," he said. We each put an arm around Merle, not 100% sure which side was his front and which his back, and faced Lance. We were touching Merle. I, like a little boy, said, "Is it really you?" It was an appropriate question because it was still extremely dark, and Merle was wearing all black, resembling more of a shadow than a music icon. Merle let out a little chuckle in response to my question, and Lance snapped the first picture. But there was no flash. Time was running out. Lance said, "Okay, now I got the flash on," and proceeded to snap the picture. We didn't make eye contact with Merle, focusing on finding the camera instead. Before we knew it, he was trotting out to the stage and picking up his guitar. We stood there, silent. It had all happened so fast.
After the show, we had the opportunity to spend some time with Ben, Merle's youngest son and guitarist. Ben was gracious enough to give us special passes to allow us to come backstage and even on the tour bus for any future Merle show. We were blown away. He ensured us that next time we could have a proper meeting with his dad. And he made good on that promise because the following year when Merle came back to play a show near L.A., we finally had the opportunity to actually board the tour bus. We weren't nearly as anxious this time around, having expended so much emotional energy during our first meeting. We were able to contain ourselves and have a conversation with Merle. We told him about our wall dedicated to him and the time we had chased his bus through South Carolina. He had watched our episode on GMM where we described our first meeting with him. It was all so surreal to be sitting on the tour bus with the man whose work had influenced us so dramatically. I think we kind of expected him to think we were crazy, but we got the sense that there are lots of people out there who have expressed the same kind of admiration for him. He took it all very humbly, and this time, we were able to get decent pictures. In late 2015, Merle was scheduled to play the Sabin again, and we were preparing for another chance to see him. He had to cancel the show at the last minute because of an illness and was never able to reschedule it as his illness got progressively worse. On his birthday, April 6, 2016, Merle passed away at the age of 79. We each sat at home that night, listening to Merle and contemplating the influence he'd had on our lives and friendship.
Merle's originality and musical genius was what initially drew us to him. But once we became super fans, we learned that a shared admiration for someone could be an incredible way to build and strengthen a friendship. There are few things more connecting than experiencing someone else getting a work of art that you also get. It's an indirect way of saying that, in some way, you get each other. It's mythical.
Being lifelong fans of Merle has also informed the way we think about our own work. We're inspired by the fact that Merle delivered a nearly unending string of songs that served as the soundtrack of our lives. To think that it's possible for us to affect others in even a fraction of the way Merle impacted us is mind-blowing and humbling.
When we think about how much we connected with his music, it reminds us that we're not creating our work in a vacuum. There's an audience who's chosen to watch the videos we've made and read the book we've written. Of course, it's doubtful that videos with titles such as "Amazing Butt Facts" or "Will It Deep Fry" can move people as much as Merle's music has moved us, but we're nevertheless floored that many out there refer to themselves as our fans. We prefer the term mythical beast.
Superfan or stalker?
When we were kids, celebrity selfies weren't really a thing. We wanted autographs. If you were lucky, you could get a signed publicity photo, book, or baseball glove. Today, with the internet and drones and conventions and virtual reality, the opportunities are endless for worshiping your pop culture heroes. However, with opportunity comes great responsibility.
There is a very fine line between superfan and stalker. Here's the line and what lies on either side of it.
Superfan. You see your idol wearing a particular brand of underwear in a picture, so you buy a pair of that same brand. Stalker. You see your idol wearing a particular brand of underwear in a picture, so you buy a pair of that same brand and send it to them with a request to wear it and return it to you.
Superfan. You sneak on stage and find one of their hairs, and you frame it. Stalker. You sneak on stage and find one of their hairs, and you make tea out of it.